The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Lovely bits of football, the slide rule pass of Mane, the volley of Mount, the crossfield arrow of Trent Alexander-Arnold and the flick of Dele Alli. All of it saw Liverpool put five past Everton, who drop into the relegation zone. How long does Silva have? Ole pats Jose on the head as Mourinho's winning run finishes at Old Trafford. Leicester's seventh win in a row as Vardy gets booked for being booted in the box. Chelsea bounce back with victory over Villa as the top four starts to look a little bit predictable. In Fitbar, a Scott Brown late show for Celtic as Rangers are held. People are shocked and amazed as Messi wins the Ballon d'Or, while there's some FIFA and money swilling about news which will surprise no one. All that plus your questions, and we are Amazon primed and ready for today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Tommy says, this seems like a very happy-go-lucky podcast without Barry Wilson or Ronnie. Yeah, a fully upbeat Simon Burnton. Nice to see you.
Hi.
Philippe Clair, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
A pod debut for Kate Mason from Sky. Kate, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
That's all right. On your bio, it says, yet to meet a sport I don't like. Have you ever been introduced to motorsport?
It's actually not true that anymore.
Okay.
I don't really like... Oh, maybe I shouldn't give this away.
All right, you're allowed to say it. Is it because on Sky Sports News you have to be like very enthusiastic about, you know,
no,
Lewis Hamilton's gear shift or whatever?
Oh, I try to be. I actually am naturally enthusiastic about most things.
That's good.
And I feel like sitting in the Barry chair may, you know, keep me tethered to the earth. But I don't like NFL. Sorry.
It's okay.
It's the head injuries thing.
Oh, is it? Oh, it's quite a serious reason for hating it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's not a great opener, is it?
No, it's fine. I mean, it's a totally acceptable reason not to like it. You know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of problems with it. We'll start with the Merseyside derby there. Liverpool 5, Everton 2. Now, form goes out of the window in derby games, but it didn't get near. It stayed in the window, didn't it? On Monday, Jonathan Wilson said he thought Everton would win this game. At 2-0, he tweeted, just to be clear, that prediction on Football Weekly about Everton getting a result at Liverpool was a satire on Barry's predictions. You did all understand that, right? Simon, this was very straightforward, wasn't it?
I don't think there was ever a point where Liverpool looked seriously in any great danger of not winning. They scored early and then quite regularly until they were comfortable enough. And they scored some absolute stunkers as well.
Didn't they? I mean, Johnny Lou says, look, this wasn't a conventional walloping and that Liverpool really weren't very good. Four first-team players left on the bench, some uncharacteristic daydreaming in defence. But the goals... Kate, I don't know which your favourite was. That pass from Mane for the first goal is amazing. And then the second goal where...
Oh, sorry to cut in. What about the second Origi goal with Dejan Lovren absolutely hoofs it out the field. One touch, two touch, straight in.
Yeah, his first touch for that was amazing. The second goal, though, I think, Philippe, is the best.
The Divock Origi, when he picks that ball which has got snow on it, is just beautiful. It's just the way he controls
it. I'm with you. The Shaqiri goal is unbelievable. Well, it's Mane's skill, right? His control of that ludicrous crossfield 60-yard pass from Alexander-Arnold. The way he controls it, the way he brings it under his spell into his stride. Fantastic. Suddenly in front of him, there's the whole defence and there's runners here and there. And he sees a run and he finds a pass. And then, you know, the slower a finish is, the better it is.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The sending the ball rolling just lazily past Pickford, like this will do.
I agree with you because I think the way Alexander-Arnold strikes that ball is it's sort of otherworldly, isn't it? We were talking about his delivery on Monday and sort of comparing it to Beckham, but that pass, I just don't know that many footballers who kick the ball like that
with that regularity.
Yeah.
Platini used to be able to do that with both feet.
Whatever happened to him?
I don't know.
It was quite odd that when the ball is in the right back position, Liverpool's right back position, that Mane is making a run 30 yards into Everton's half. Like, what's he doing there? How's he allowed to be there? Why aren't they? I know he's got pace and the Everton defence don't. But to get from just outside your own penalty area to not far from Everton's penalty area in one kick shouldn't be that. It shouldn't be possible.
No.
If the defence is on the halfway line, that kick's not available. You need to play it into Mane's feet or at least give a lot more like make a lot more work for Mane to do.
Is it the slow laziness of the finish so enjoyable? Because in some way, it's a bit like having a tiny insight into what it's like to be an elite footballer. Because, you know, people will say, you know, really elite athletes see the ball slower than the rest of us. And when you see that finish, you know exactly what's about to happen before it's happened. It's so enjoyable.
It's just, as a move, it had everything, right? It had the bludgeon of the initial pass. It had the silk of the Mane control. It had the vision and it had the nonchalance. I mean, it ticked all the boxes.
And we've talked about how Liverpool, oh, this is a tough December and they might struggle because they never rest the front three. And there was Shaqiri starting his first league game since January, Lallana starting his second game of the season.
Divock Origi.
And Divock Origi, right, who played really, really well, actually.
Yes, indeed. And that's the leitmotiv of the season, is that whichever questions you throw at Liverpool, they find an answer. And the answers are sometimes completely, well, you would never have dreamt of them beforehand. I mean, were you expecting such a lineup in the Merseyside derby? Certainly not, especially against an Everton side which genuinely needed to get something out of the game. And then you realise, well, people say it's not the deepest of benches. There's also the absence of Fabinho, by the way, which we haven't even mentioned. And it's Wijnaldum who is playing in that role and, you know, playing absolutely beautifully. And it's amazing because I think you started by saying, oh, perhaps not the most convincing of Liverpool victories. And actually, we're actually now saying, well, it was extremely convincing. And the fact that they were able to roll, you know, through that game in that way makes me think that December might not be such a big problem after all.
Apparently, Marco Silva is going to be sacked while we're talking or after this is published or in between times, and Moyes is set for an interim. But I thought for the second game in a row, for the second defeat in a row, Everton sort of looked okay.
Yeah, someone on the pod, I think on Monday, was saying the fans haven't warmed up to him. They're not backing him at this point. As we know, we heard them chanting against him in a home game, but partly because he's not demonstrative on the sidelines. He doesn't look as though he's really, you know, living every moment. But I actually thought at the end of the Leicester game, he looked pretty broken. So part of me thinks, perhaps similarly with Pochettino, it is the correct moment for him to get out of there with his dignity.
Does he have his dignity? I mean, I'm trying to work out. He's had such a strange... He's dignified, but he's had a strange career in that since he came here, that he hasn't really done anything anywhere. But his stock, you know, is not as low as Alan Kerbishley's.
Well, former colleagues of mine used to get very exercised about the idea that Marco Silva was seen as this anti-Sam Allardyce. You know, he was this urbane, you know, footballing brain. And then Sam Allardyce was, you know, keeps you up, route one.
Do they have names, these former colleagues?
No, they have no names. No. Okay. No. None whatsoever.
What I would say on a practical level, they played last night. It's Thursday today. They play a game again on Saturday. If they were to sack their manager today, they'd have a new manager coming in on Thursday afternoon. They'd have one training session with a new manager. It might just not be enough on a practical level to organise the team efficiently for a game against Chelsea on Saturday. And if they were to replicate, you know, it is possible that Silva could get a result out of that game with this team. So maybe this is not quite the moment.
Usually you try to wait until there's an easy run of games to sack the manager, which is really perverted, isn't it? You think, which is what happened to Mourinho, because the games that Solskjaer had afterwards were actually so-called easy games, which is what happened to Pochettino, because the games that Mourinho had were so-called easy games. The thing is that perhaps, I mean, there's a feeling that Moshiri, the owner, majority shareholder of Everton, is somebody who has been very loyal to Silva. And remember last season, they had an absolutely rotten winter and beginning of the spring, and during which, you know, his position was extremely insecure. They stuck by him, and actually the team started to play much better, and actually a very decent end of the season. So there might be at the back of their minds, well, maybe we're living through what we already lived through. We should actually stick with the manager. But the problem is that you don't really have any idea of the direction they're supposed to take. But is that because of Marco Silva? Or is it because of the fact that they've bought left, right and centre without too much thinking of where they should buy and what they should buy to start with?
Well, they've been unlucky with injuries, though, haven't they?
Who hasn't been? I mean, Unai Emery was unlucky with injuries. You could say Pep Guardiola has been unlucky with injuries. Everybody has been unlucky with injuries.
It's true. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you will find out probably before we do about you'll know what's happened to Marco Silva before you listen to this. To then Jose, who had that easy run of games. He had another easy one last night at Old Trafford. Robbie Dunn tweeting, Mourinho finally has United playing well. Signe Amtoft, hope I pronounced that correctly. Wow, Spurs are doing everything they can to avoid seeing Pochettino at United. Other people saying, you know, has Jose finally made Fred good? 2 for Marcus Rashford. That's the end of Jose's 100% record as Spurs manager. I mean, it would, Kate, have been a travesty if United hadn't won that game. How impressed with them were you, and who impressed you?
In the United side? Mm. Oh, my goodness. Well, was it not Fred that Dele fought off to score that incredible goal?
Yes. So Fred, no. I mean, apart from that, I mean, that was, I mean, okay, that is the moment of the game. It is such an amazing piece of skill, strength and skill. And you know when VAR were checking it and you were like, oh, I mean, it was so nice to see so many replays of that goal, but please don't disallow that. It was pretty much the only good thing Spurs did all night, but it was beautiful.
I think you're being a bit hard on Spurs, but we can come on to that. But in terms of that goal, yeah, it was incredible. Dele Alli just like hold it, just so strong, holding off Fred, not giving an inch, then basically looping it over his head, didn't he? And then at short range, putting it past. In fact, through the right arm and right leg of David De Gea, one of the world's best goalkeepers, even now.
Yeah, it was a thing of beauty.
Le coup du sombrero, it's called in French what he did.
Okay, which translates?
Sombrero, le coup du chapeau, the hat trick.
The hat trick?
Not the hat trick, the hat's trick.
Okay.
I suppose it's because you put the ball over your head as if you were putting a hat on your head or something like that.
It was like he was placing
Patrick Vieira was a specialist of that, of course. And by the way, that was very reminiscent of Dele's famous goal against Crystal Palace, wasn't it?
The finish was less exciting, but the touch was better, actually. Mm. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Simon?
It was a beautiful goal. I was live blogging for The Guardian last night, and I was getting quite a lot of emails saying, I don't see how that can't be disallowed. That's got to be disallowed. That is obviously a handball. From people, I mean, they may well have been Spurs fans, who knows? I mean United fans. But it seemed weird that we were watching it so many times. Like, the thing maybe brushed a bit of fabric on its way past, but there was no movement of arm. Even the bit of arm it maybe brushed was irrelevant. I don't know. It was weird. It was one of those weird things where VAR's just suddenly looking at something it's got no business looking
maybe
at.
Maybe they were just enjoying
it. Yeah, perhaps they were just having a lovely time with all of the slow motion replays. It's probably what it was.
Oh, well, it means we don't have to have that debate about where the arm begins and the shoulder ends. On to United, Simon. And they were really good, I thought.
They were really good. I wondered if Spurs were maybe missing a bit of midfield muscle. United seem to have quite a lot of space to enjoy themselves outside the Tottenham area. But United do have a lot of pace and a lot of ability in attack. And, you know, Greenwood is a fantastic talent. And, you know, that potential is there. It's just not there often enough.
Hmm. Philippe, every time defenders. So for the first goal, Rashford's goal, and he strikes it well, and Gazzaniga probably should have done better. But Davinson Sanchez is kind of in control of the ball, and if he wants to, he can just boot it out for a throw-in. And there is an absolute... It is almost like it's the biggest crime in football for a defender to just kick it out for a throw. And
with a jersey, not for a long time.
Well, I know, but I don't understand that. And then for the second goal as well, I mean, Sissoko, who has been good, right, for the last year or so.
Oh, very much so.
I don't know what's he doing.
He doesn't know himself, obviously.
And that is a problem when you have two players like him and Aurier down the right who are both...
Clumsy. Aurier was Aurier, and some games you see him and you think, oh, he might just be the best right back on the planet.
And then he gets sent off.
And then he gets sent off, or he does something stupid, or he crosses the ball in row Z, or he just sends a floating ball towards the opposition goalkeeper, and so on.
More horrible than Aurier, maybe.
Very good.
Maybe we should keep it at that.
Will we say
and just
very
say
good?
I said very good. Sorry. I'm with you, Simon, on the simple side of this table. Did Jose get it wrong yesterday? I thought putting Vertonghen against Dan James was also quite a strange decision.
I don't know if it's a case of him getting it wrong. I think it's more a case of this strange perception that somehow he had already changed the team in the past three games, and which wasn't the case. I was at West Ham, the West Ham game for my sins, by the way. The first 20 minutes or so, Tottenham were actually quite mediocre. It's just West Ham were just awful, abysmal. They played against Olympiacos, one of the worst away teams in the Champions League, which also is not the Olympiacos of 5-6 years ago when they were winning the league, you know, year in, year out. And then they were 2-0 down. And you think, oh, okay. And suddenly we're thinking, oh, he's brought back this winning mentality and so forth. Well, I don't think so. I mean, he's only been there 5 minutes. And for once, when he said, guys, I basically have got 2 days or 3 days between the games at the moment. We don't have time to train properly. What we have time for is recuperation, rest and recuperation. So it might just be that we've got to be a little bit more patient, and then the Tottenham we see is still Tottenham, which is a little bit in shock.
Yeah, guys, it's a myth, isn't it, that people want to believe. People want to believe that you can just sign Mourinho and then Tottenham is solved. And exactly to your point, Philippe, you know, the easy games, no disrespect, of course, to West Ham and Bournemouth, or indeed Olympiacos, but Spurs did manage to concede twice at the beginning of that Champions League game and then twice at the end of the other two.
So that's twice 4 games on the trot.
Yeah, of course. It's not a case of, well, we think that Mourinho is going to want to make things work at Tottenham to prove that he's not yesterday's man, and that Manchester United, his time there was a blip, although his greatest achievement, of course, in football was getting them to finish second in the league. You know, you can't take that away from him. But this is one of the cases, I think, where the narrative of football gets ahead of the reality of the football that is being played. And Eriksen will leave, surely, in January. He's being brought on. Now, that, to me, was worrying because I think towards the end of Pochettino's reign, the issue was that he, much like Unai Emery, actually was going back on some of the decisions he'd made. You know, you need to set your course and stick to it within reason. Eriksen, if he's gone, then he shouldn't be being brought on to try and save the game. Equally, Lo Celso, I don't know, he had some pretty heavy touches last night.
I felt he must have been really cold, and he's not been on the pitch. I mean, he's barely played.
Yeah, and friends of mine who watch more Spanish football say that, yes, he's a bargain if you can get him in January for whatever it was, quoted 27 million, then definitely hang on to him. But it's hard to really know on the evidence of not very much.
And I know they'd had that success against Bournemouth with like balls over the sort of Dejan Lovren to Origi, you know, those balls from Aldevira up to Ali. But I thought they just tried it all the time to virtually no one, Simon. I just thought it was slightly League Two long ball, which seems counterintuitive for those players who've been trying to play lovely football for the last 5 years.
Yeah. Well, if that's what it was, they're playing Burnley on Saturday, so
one for the purists.
Yeah.
Is this symptomatic of the whole issue of appointing Mourinho at Tottenham after 5.5 years of Mauricio Pochettino, which is that this seems to be rip it all up and start again. Build something gradually, piece by piece. You know, I don't know about the narrative of Mourinho, the great destroyer. I don't know how much you can destroy in a period of how long he's going to be there, 3 years? 2.5, 2 years.
The players actually have said, yes, we've been encouraged to play longer, to be more direct.
But I felt they did it almost every time they had it yesterday.
Yeah, but that's not really his DNA. If you think of his great sides, even when he had Drogba, but he also had Duff and Robben, so it was very much a question of crossing. And sometimes they would use Drogba's, you know, magnificent talent in counter-attack. But on the otherwise, they were quite slow in the build-up sometimes. His second team at Chelsea, which had got Fabregas, Oscar, Hazard, was a team which actually was quite easy on the eye for a while. It was not long ball at all. So it's almost as if, we got to try something completely different and see what happens, which is not really more in your way of going about things.
Could it have been a result of the fact that whenever, especially in the first 30 minutes, whenever Tottenham got the ball, there'd be three Manchester United players like a magnet and filings. They'd be straight on them.
So we have to credit. So because we have constantly haven't given him any credit probably on this, but he's probably got no credit anywhere in the last sort of year and a half. Maybe when he had that good little run. But did he tactically get it right, or has he just got some good players who sometimes play well. What is it? Because Manchester United fans will have listened to the analysis of this game so far and say, this isn't just about Spurs being bad. This has got to be about United pressing at the right time, winning the midfield battle and having Marcus Rashford playing very well.
Yeah, I think you've summed it up. The press was...
Thank you so much. It's taken 2 years.
And to beat the press, either you are very confident and you play very intricately in, triangles from the back, or you hoof it long. I mean, I don't know what a Spurs fan will think of it, but I think there's one player who is no longer there who was very important in that really beautiful Tottenham team of about 2 years ago and 3 years ago, which is Dembele, midfielder who had also the technique and the physical presence to be able to find space and weave his way around the midfield and create it. Actually, the midfield was much more creative than it is now. And, you know, Winks is not that and Lo Celso is not that. And they haven't got this player. It's true that Dembele, Moussa Dembele, will never be the player we all dreamt him to be. But it's missing. There's a creative spark missing there in midfield. That's not new.
Hopefully Dan James is all right after headbutting Jose Mourinho's shin with... quite exceptional force. It was one of those where the commentators went, isn't that funny? Look how injured Mourinho is and it's hobbling about. And then they saw a sort of concussed man on the level where suddenly had to go slightly serious.
Also, we should mention Scott McTominay.
He played well.
That's who I should have said at the beginning. But also, I don't know if you heard in the press conference afterwards, Mourinho said the globality of his performance was wonderful. He was dominant, which I think is fair, but it almost was like, couldn't help thinking it was a little nudge back to when he gave him manager's player of the year. He's saying, I identified this talent. I made him.
Yeah. And I think, for me, when I'm watching a game, what I really want from a player is globality, isn't it? That's the main takeaway.
If you haven't got globality, what have you got?
Nothing. That'll do for part one. We'll begin part two at the King Power. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Some live shows for you. December the 20th, Belgrave Music Hall in Leeds. We've sold out me, Lars Wilson and one more. Look forward to seeing you if you're there. The 20th of January at the Salus Benny Theatre in Brighton. Me, Barry, Ellis James and Nicky Bandini. And the 28th of January, we sold out the 27th at Liberty Hall in Dublin. But the 28th, there are a few tickets still left. Me, Barry, plus two. To the King Power then, Leicester City 2, Watford 0, 7 wins in a row for Leicester. Their best run since 1963, second 8 points off the top, but 12 points above 5th place. They're quite good for Leap, aren't they?
Yeah, reasonably so, yeah. Do you have their schedule actually for December? Because that's going to be interesting, because this is when the big guns are now going to line up to meet Brendan Rodgers, band of merry men.
So they've got Villa away, Norwich at home, Everton away in the Carabao, and then they have this, their Christmas is fun, right?
Yes.
21st of December, City away, Boxing Day, Liverpool at home. It will be fascinating to see how they do against both those teams, actually.
Yeah, and they're in a position where it's amazing, is that nobody mentions the fact that they're second in the league on merit. And in fact, they could be closer to Liverpool because... a couple of their, well, the defeat, certainly the one against Manchester United, was, I don't like to use the word undeserved, but let's use it anyway.
And they lost very late on at Liverpool, didn't they?
And Liverpool, the Mane incident and the penalty and so forth, which was quite miraculous. And you think, well, they could be actually 2 points closer at least.
But they also win late, don't they? I mean, look at how late they won against Everton, who we were just talking about. I think they the team with the most late goals in the league so far.
They're obviously a completely relaxed, happy team. And it's amazing what it does to you, because it's not as if they know. You look, it's a very good first 11, you even maybe first 13, 14. Obviously, the atmosphere there is absolutely brilliant. And I can actually vouch for that through Yuri Tielemans, the Belgian player who had loads of offers during the summer. And he basically said, no, I'm not interested. This is such a good place to be.
Can you see Rodgers going to Arsenal?
I think it'd be very silly to leave for Arsenal at the moment. Very, very silly. But why not? Yes.
A man of his ambition.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I suppose those jobs don't... do they come around often? Maybe they do.
The Arsenal job might come around quite often in the next few years.
You're probably right.
Also, if you really want a rebuilding, big, massive rebuilding job that's very difficult at a club where people have extremely high expectations.
True.
Do you want that?
True. And Brendan Rodgers isn't the kind of guy to leave mid-season when his side are doing well, is it? How has Jamie Vardy been booked, please, Simon, in that moment where he gets kicked over?
He got booked because he dived. Right, I'll come on to that.
Okay.
Leicester should have scored lots of goals last night, but they shouldn't have scored either of the two they scored. And they should have got a penalty, but not the penalty they got.
I agree with that.
I do think it was a penalty, but I do think it was a dive. Like it is very clear from the way he goes down that it wasn't the foul that brought him down. So it's a dive. I mean, if he wasn't brought down by the foul, it's a dive. He dived. That's why he got booked, because he dived.
But you can be diving and fouled at the same time.
Sure.
And there doesn't need to be contact for a foul to be awarded.
So could you give a penalty and still book Jamie Vardy for diving? Because that's what should happen there.
But, I mean, his fall was not caused by an action of his opposition. It was a dive, so I think probably fair enough. But it did look like a foul, so probably a penalty.
That's amazing.
So who was the VAR? I mean, it was Craig Pawson reffing. I wondered who was in the VAR room. It was obviously, that, as we've understood with the VAR room, if you're a more junior referee, you can't overturn the decision. So it must have, maybe it was just a small child who was just very scared of Craig.
That was the whole problem at the Women's World Cup, right? All of the really experienced refs were in the VAR room. And all of the really inexperienced new female refs were out on the pitch taking the wrath and just
being
overruled all the decisions
all the time.
Yes, thank you. Tell me how to referee.
So he did even it up, because he gave that penalty for Messina heading a clearance, as far as I could tell. And then Messina made an amazing goal line clearance. And I think goal line clearances are very underrated parts of football. They kind of happen and we go, oh, that was great. But they never get the analysis that I am currently giving them for the first time ever. So
absolutely,
well done to me for that.
Come on, let's have a bit more, shall we?
I just think there is a real skill when you're running at extraordinary pace and the goal is actually quite a big thing and you've got to make sure you don't put the ball in it. That's really what a goal line clearance ultimately is.
And I think there is one player who is probably the greatest line clearer of all times, and Ashley Cole.
Was he very good?
He was absolutely astonishing. And I think people didn't realise that it was part of his value as a great and perhaps best left-hand side defender we've had in this country. So, but the number of clearances he made, last-ditch ones, absolutely extraordinary. And never scored an own goal, by the way.
I bet there isn't a compilation of that on the internet. Perhaps
there
now is the moment.
One.
I bet there isn't, though, because to Max's point, do we respect these goal line clearances as much as we ought?
It's a very good question. I'll ask Simon a question about Watford, and while he's talking, I will do nothing but YouTube Ashley Cole goal line clearances, as I'm sure everyone listening at home is doing right now. Madison scored in the 95th minute, bundled through Watford, basically. Hayden Mullins afterwards, who is their temporary manager, said there were loads of positives. I didn't see any. Simon, did you see some?
Yeah.
With your Watford hat on?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Firstly, Troy Deeney was back in the starting 11. It was Kike Sanchez Flores' great misfortune that Deeney was basically injured for his entire second reign. Although he was back for the Southampton game and ludicrously and criminally unused. And I think that is probably what did for Sanchez Flores. His terrible substitutions in his last game just made him look inept. And I wonder what it is about managers sometimes who... and I think Unai Emery was the same in his last game at Arsenal, who basically used substitutions as resignation notes.
Do you think it's the panic? You know, when you're panicking, it's very difficult to think clearly and to make good decisions.
I honestly have no idea what would lead a sentient human to one all in that Southampton game. Southampton have a free kick, a shooting opportunity, and the manager at that point, with the club's kind of talisman and figurehead on the bench, thinks that what he's going to do, he's going to take off a right back and bring on a slightly worse right back. Yeah. Anyway, the managers are not the issue so much at Watford, and it is a distraction to concentrate on the managers and the way everyone is. The issue is the squad, and that there is only one centre forward, essentially. Welbeck was signed in the summer, but it's hard to rely on him, and so it's proved. And Andre Gray is not of the requisite standard and can't lead a line and hold the ball and bring people into play. And Dean is the only man who could do that. And he's been injured for months. And without him, the squad is just ludicrously weakened to the extent that it is where it is now. So yesterday we had Deeney starting an attack and we had Delafeu and Saar playing off him. And there's hope from there. I know Watford last night had one shot on target. It was in the 94th minute. It was
a third of the speed of Shaqiri's finish as well. I know slow finishes are great, but
yeah. So it's not like they were transformed into an attacking force, although there were chances that didn't quite make it as far as goals, as shots on goal. But with Deeney and Saar and Delafeu or Pereira playing off him, there is hope in attack, which there has not been for months, and that was there last night. The other issue with the squad building and is the defence, which basically has been ignored. Our back four last night were...
It's Jaden Merritt.
I mean, might as well have been. So we had Foster in goal, who cost us £4 million. We had a right-back, Firmino, free transfer. Cathcart at centre-back, free transfer. Mariappa at centre-back, free transfer. And Messina, who cost a couple of million from Bologna. Like, there has been no attention paid to that defence. It is players who've been there for years and cost nothing. And what you cannot do in the Premier League is stand still. You know, if you think, looking at the squad at the end of last season, a club like Watford's looks at their squad and thinks, that'll do, then they're in trouble.
Let's go to Turf Moor. Burnley 1, Manchester City 4. Gabriel Jesus scoring the first goal of the Amazon Prime era. We'll get onto Amazon in just a second. I mean, what a great...
I mean, all the goals there were ridiculously good.
I mean, his first... That finish is... I mean, it's out of nothing. That's the only place he can put it. The second goal is the most inviting cross from Bernardo and a lovely volley. Rodri, as Sterling tweeted, if he hadn't got his head out of the way, you know...
Decapitation.
Yeah. And Mahrez got a nice one at the end, the fifth best player in the world.
With his wrong foot, if I'm not mistaken.
With his wrong foot. Given Sergio Aguero's injury, you know, Jesus has to step up. And on that showing, Philippe, he can, right?
Yes, and there were goals. I mean, especially the first one is not one that I would necessarily think as a Gabriel Jesus goal. You know, he's more of a fox in the box type of player. But he's always been... And trust, I mean, he has the trust of Pep Guardiola. In Brazil as well, people rate him extremely highly. I've always thought of him as being one of the possible great centre forwards that they could have. And obviously the guy psychologically has dealt very well with the competition with Sergio Aguero. But that, on that showing, yes, he was absolutely magnificent that night. So, not too many problems on that side at Manchester City. What a surprise. But they needed that, didn't they? Because... They'd looked a little bit heavy-legged and lacking in joy, shall we say. And this was quite a joyful occasion.
And Rodri was superb as well. And Rodri is very important if Fernandinho's playing where he's playing, right?
Yeah. you would have to keep your judgment, perhaps, for that. Because we all know how good he can be and how important he is, precisely with the idea we need somebody to take over from Fernandinho at one point. Maybe the level of opposition perhaps was not, you know, on one showing of that quality. I mean, he's been good. At the very beginning, he looked like he fitted really well within the squad, within the team. I don't think you're too overexcited by that. But the way he cut across the ball and to get this kind of in-swinger, just like a bowler, beautiful.
But it was...
Across the seam.
It's nowhere near De Bruyne's volley, is it?
That was so lovely.
Mm. Yeah.
It's so enjoyable to think about that. I think old Jonjo Shelvey in the Newcastle game didn't get enough love as a result of
being next to the
beauty of
De Bruyne. But I think it's the way that Shelvey hits it with the instep. So it doesn't feel like the thwack of the proper half volley when you hit it with the laces, either straight like Kevin De Bruyne or across and impacting. Which is why I love about the Rodri goal is the fact that it's the effect, the sound of Roberto Carlos-y thingy that he does to the ball.
Chelsea 2, Villa 1. Chelsea 6 points clear in fourth, Simon. Is this top four kind of... I said in the intro, it's kind of predictable now. It's early in the season, but it sort of feels like that, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, it might feel predictable now. It certainly isn't what many predicted at the start of the season.
No.
And it remains... You know, for the shape of this Chelsea team is now established, but it remains... astonishing, given how bad they've been at bringing through Academy graduates to see Reece James set up Tammy Abraham and Tammy Abraham set up Mason Mount. And for that just to be, yeah, that's just what happens now. It is, you know, a club totally redefined.
Can we talk about Reece James a bit? Because he looks so exciting. And we've talked a lot about Tammy Abraham, but, you know, England's right back position is sort of ludicrously strong. But he looks such a great talent.
He does. He's strong in all the right areas. And his cross for the ball in for that first goal was really lovely. Really an excellent delivery.
While we're on volleys, where are we putting Mason Mount on the De Bruyne scale?
Decent.
Okay.
Sometimes, you know, football is such an improvised game. But I like, Tammy Abraham said afterwards, at half-time he'd said to Mason Mount, just stay close to me, I'm going to set you up. And, you know, ball comes into the striker, you don't necessarily expect them to be chesting it down to a midfielder. I love how that was premeditated and delivered.
And the chest is also, while we're on things that are underrated in football, a good chest it gives me great pleasure.
Absolutely. It's also not a hand, which is fantastic news.
Exactly right, really helps with the whole laws of the game.
You've got to mention Trezeguet's goal. Well, I mean, what a finish that was. I mean, that was really that's one of the great clueless, hapless finishes.
To head it into your shin.
He headed it straight into the ground, like literally straight down, straight off his head and straight down.
It's quite hard.
I know, it's hard. I had to even do that.
They all count, Simon. They all count.
Yeah. Also, the thing we kept saying last night about it on Sky was that it's the first time ever in the Premier League that a goal has been assisted and scored by Egyptians.
Yeah.
But I really love that he's called himself Trezeguet, this Egyptian guy. Like, if you were starting out as a footballer, if I was being a footballer, I would just call myself Martyr. I'd just be like, well, my nickname is Martyr. So, you know, that's just, I don't know, if you think of Martyr when you see me play, then that's just you. That's on you. It's like, how can you go and do that? It's unbelievable.
There we go. I had no idea. Mahmoud Ahmed Ibrahim Hassan.
Yeah, it's just a name.
Call me Trezeguet.
Right.
You know, every child is on the school playing field is like, yeah, I'm... Like, today I used to like being Jan Molby back in the day, strolling around midfield.
Wonderful.
But I don't have to run, I'm Jan Molby.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Who would you take? Oh, the idea I'd take Grant Holt. There you go.
Wouldn't.
Yes, I would. I'd like to be, from now on, I'd like to be known as Grant Holt.
It's got to be one name anyway.
Holt. to Molyneux, Wolves 2, West Ham 0. No tears, and not quite such a fairy tale for David Martin. But he didn't do much wrong, did he? But Wolves, Kate, in fifth. I think I was doing the maths earlier, counting. Unbeaten in 16 games in all competitions.
It's unbelievable. And that was their 28th game last night.
Yeah.
Which, given that Nuno never rotates, really, he took the same players to Braga to play. I don't know if you saw the Europa League game. It was just unbelievable. It was absolutely just pouring with rain from start to finish. The entire pitch was just like a sort of, I don't know, crumbly little swimming pool with a few tufts of grass in it. It was horrible. And they still were managing to string together these moves put together flair moves on a pitch that you pretty much couldn't run on with these players who've played, at that stage, have played 26 games this season already. I mean, I suppose you could argue that, you know, because they're playing together so well and so often, they're clicking and this is why. But it just seems extraordinary to me. And
especially when you think of the beginning of the season, which was really tough for them, where they had all these one-all draws. I mean, every single game seemed to be a one-all draw. And they were actually at one point, were they in the relegation zone? They might have even have been at one point after five or six rounds or something like that.
Yeah, they hadn't won.
And also, it's alphabetical at the start.
Yeah, true. Yeah. That's a real issue for Wolves.
And also, the thing is that people tend to think of Espirito Santo as somebody who is, you know, obviously a very fine coach, but somewhat sort of set in his ways. He's got his, you know, 3-4-1-2, whatever you want to call it, and that's that. And in fact, this season, I think there's one thing which has brought a huge change in the way they play. It's Adama Traoré playing. At the beginning of the season, he wasn't. And then suddenly, he puts him on the right. And everybody knows that Traoré is the one, you know, the guy who goes at 100 miles an hour, what he was at Middlesbrough and so forth, will never do anything else.
Speedboat, no driver.
Exactly, except it's working.
He's got a driver now.
He's got a driver. That, I think, is... There's also quite a lot about the talent of the manager. And by the way, Raul Jimenez is one of the most wonderful players in the league.
How good is he, please?
He's not. The thing is that he's not a goal scorer. It's like that nobody thinks of him as a great number nine, but as a footballer, he's just exquisite. He's got everything.
His run from the left wing to set up the second goal was really good yesterday, yeah. I thought.
They got him for almost nothing. 20 million or something like that?
Bargain.
Rally driving voiceover is clearly paying well, Philippe. To St Mary's, Southampton 2, Norwich 1. Southampton with two wins on the bounce for the first time since March. And that was after that point at Arsenal, wasn't it? A good response, Simon, since getting smashed at home by Leicester City.
Yeah, really admirable. And just Ward-Prowse, has his delivery from set pieces for years has been superb. And you know, that with that, there is hope, you know. And both goals yesterday from Ward-Prowse set pieces. Ings, you know, being the striker he looked like he could be when he first came through at Burnley. And he's one of those players now. I think if you see a player get injured more than once, if you see a player get injured a couple of times, I think he takes a bit of your soul. I think Danny Ings has a bit of all English football fans with him. Don't you think?
As in, you love him more, or he's taken a bit of my soul and I am more soulless than I was?
I am happy for his success in a way that I am not for the success of most players I've got no interest in.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was a kind of Harry Potter Horcrux reference. I wasn't.
No, it's got nothing to do with it. No.
It's not about making me soulless. I agree with you. It's about you look at him and you think fair play. Because football fans, I don't think, appreciate, perhaps once you have had, you know, ACL injuries themselves, quite how sort of energy sapping and painful rehab is. And to do it and to get back to that level and to score, 10 this season in a side that don't create a lot of chances.
10?
Yeah.
My goodness.
And, you know, it's a cliche, but if you have one player that scores you 20 goals, that keeps you in the division, and they're out of the relegation zone now. Timu Pukki scored what I decided was a kind of Poundland Jeff Hurst finish, wasn't it? There were no people on the pitch, but he did run in from the left and put it into the top left-hand corner in a slight nod to Sir Jeff. Is anyone with me?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
For a goalkeeper to get beaten at the near post is, like, always embarrassing. And Rashford's first goal yesterday,
Gazzaniga, yeah.
A case in point. But if it goes hard enough and fast enough, it becomes just cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Okay. Crystal Palace 1, Bournemouth 0. One of the most boring games I've ever had the misfortune of
watching. So.
Did you actually? Did you really? No, what part of you?
I don't know. Well, I always enjoy, you know, basic things. Like, I always enjoy watching Zaha. I enjoyed how in the first half he kind of ran into a corner and didn't pass, didn't look up. And then he had exactly the same situation in the second half. And he did try and look up and find find someone to assist, but they weren't there. So I enjoyed seeing Zaha like learn through the course of the game. I enjoyed that the kickoff went wrong.
It's like it's not a documentary about like a baby deer that falls over and then eventually learns.
I really love, you know, the growth mindset.
Do you think that was the moment where Wilfried Zaha decided he needed to pass the ball? Like in his whole career.
Yeah, I think it might have been a really seminal moment for him. Also, I really enjoyed the fact that the kickoff went wrong, didn't it? They had to retake kickoff.
What happened in the kickoff is the short.
They just had to retake it. I guess.
Well, you have really low.
But that's fine. That's entertaining, isn't it? In professional football, that is entertaining.
Yeah, like, I suppose so.
It's like when people mess up a throw in.
The highlight of the game happened literally like before the game started.
I'm not saying
it was downhill from there.
I'm not saying it was the highlight.
Once they kicked off
of the game, and then, anyway, frankly, I like it when Palace win. I think it's nice, and I.
But you're not a Palace fan.
No.
It was one point I because I didn't watch the game that particular game.
Well, you really missed out.
No, wait a minute. Then I thought, no, I've got to make use of the Amazon highlights. Thingamajig, and I went to, and I pressed highlights, and I watched. I thought, oh dear, I didn't want the whole game. And I realized these were the highlights. Yeah. It was like the ball not reaching the penalty box, but somebody taking a shot, rolling it tamely in the keeper's arms or whatever. That was the highlights.
On Match of the Day, Danny Murphy said he'd have been disappointed if he'd been sent off for the Mamadou Sakho 100 miles an hour tearing into Adam Smith.
Yeah.
I mean, he did clear the ball before he took the player, but I think we all realise that that is a red card. Yes, look, Bournemouth had 70% possession, pretty much. Managed just 6 shots all game. They've won 10 out of their last 38. Eddie Howe clearly shouldn't be worried about his job. Or should he? Should he be worried about something?
It's four straight defeats, isn't it?
Mm.
It's the question of that. I genuinely do think that there has to come a moment in his career when he's going to take a harder option. And he's been at that club for a very long time. He's done absolutely magnificent things with this club. I genuinely don't think that they have the financial resources to get the kind of players which would enable him to perhaps fight for something else than honourable, staying in the Premier League. And you think, well, you know, you can only go so far. If you want to know how good you can be, perhaps the time has to come at some point. And you also get the feeling that the players must feel the same thing. I mean, obviously they relate to him, but they're also unbelievably inconsistent. Bournemouth is a team I never do any prognosis for any of their games. You never know what you're going to get. And you do have a feeling that it's hitting a glass ceiling there. I mean, I'm probably being far too tough on somebody who's taken them through the divisions and maintained them with very small stadiums, small means and so forth, at an honourable place in the elite. But you know, there's a moment, come on.
Does he have to, though, anyhow? Because I think, you know, it's a bit like a Matt Le Tissier sort of situation.
He could just be there forever, do you think?
Is there something...
And there's nothing wrong with that, by the way, if he's happy that way and if it's that... Yeah, absolutely.
He has tried leaving before. It didn't go very well.
At Burnley, yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose what we're all searching for happiness, right? Whatever that takes. And if Eddie has it, with Jason Tindall next to him, just in Bournemouth, who are we to question?
Good luck to them.
Yeah.
People say that, you know, Harry Kane should leave Tottenham, for example. I don't think necessarily that he will, because I think also he is a man like Eddie Howe, like Matt Le Tissier, who sets himself in his place, he's happy with what he knows, and he has a conservative mindset, perhaps. Perhaps we should all be more Eddie Howe.
Is there any searching?
George, you've made me change my mind completely, Kate.
Is there any pod equivalent of someone set in their ways who's been doing the same thing over and over again? I can't think of one. Can we talk about Amazon Prime? So this was their debut in streaming all the games, so you could watch all of them, which was a problem because it meant you could watch the Crystal Palace Bournemouth game. I think half our listeners are in the UK and half of them are around the world, and it will surprise the half that are around the world. If you're in America, you can watch all the games whenever they're on. If you're in Australia, you can watch all the games. If you're in the UK, you can't. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time you could watch every single one. Maybe because I just don't like change. I didn't like the choice. I didn't like the fact that I could watch whatever game I wanted to. In a way, because I thought, I like it when... So I want to see Tottenham more than other Premier League sides. So I like it when they're on the telly, and I sort of feel like I need to earn the right. I can't have all their games on, because then I'm sort of cheating. Obviously, this is where it will end up, isn't it?
And also, I like the idea of watching Match of the Day, for example. Mm-hmm. And Saturday, I've concentrated on one or two games, perhaps on Saturday. Then I look forward to, oh, and that's what happened elsewhere. I'm intrigued. I'd like to find out. Choice, yes. No, it's fake choice anyway.
Well, it was fake in that they said, we're broadcasting all the games. You can watch them all. So I tried to watch them all. And in fact, you could only watch three. And after that, they say you've got too many streams running from one account. And so I couldn't watch them all.
So did you? You had what? Telly, laptop, phone?
No, I had three windows in my. I've got this new monitor for my computer.
Oh, okay,
wow.
And it is wide. It's quite wide.
Yeah.
And so I had three screens on my computer monitor.
My God!
But you were doing Clockwatch,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you didn't know. You were just speculating about some of these goals. You were doing Max.
It's like being in a kind of CCTV kind of thing, right?
So Jesus scores. Oh no, it's not him.
So they had a goals on Saturday type show where they showed you every goal when it happened, and they were also broadcasting all the individual games. So I had the show that showed bits of everything, and I had two games running as well, and I would have had them all. I wanted every one of them.
I wouldn't have been capable.
So I had the three. The setup on my screen was great, but then I thought what I could do with is one running on my phone as well.
Mm.
But they wouldn't let me have that.
I'm worried that any criticism I give is because I'm the only broadcaster who wasn't asked to host one of the games.
Max.
But did we think they sort of took a quite an understated approach? You know, they I don't know if they ever said they were going to sort of change it about, but you know, everyone was a sort of regular broadcaster, which is actually probably not a silly idea, is it?
The production company was Sunset Vine, I think, who do a lot of sport. And it was in safe hands in every turn. Like the production company was familiar, and those pundits were familiar, and the presenters were familiar. It was actually quite overwhelming at the start of the programming when they went round the grounds, and there was, you know, a panel that you would expect to be there presenting a Premier League show, a Premier League match, and then there was another one, and then there was another one, and then another, and another. Like, it was a little bit overwhelming in that way.
I just want to mention the fact that Jonathan Liu wrote an absolutely magnificent piece on this first by Amazon, which also is looking at the bigger picture, which is probably also what we should be thinking of, and the idea that people might say, well, it's wonderful, because it was quite fluffy, wasn't it? I mean, it was totally non-aggressive. There were no big signs. There were no ads for betting companies, which was actually quite a relief. All these sort of things. And they said, oh, it's quite nice. It's quite warm and cozy and so forth. Remember who is doing it, guys. It's a totalitarian company, basically. They want to control every single aspect of your life.
Producer Danielle, just bowing her head.
Totalitarian needn't be taken in the political sense or the usual sense. It just means to control the totality of your lives. Mm-hmm. And I think Jonathan put it absolutely beautifully in his piece. So read it.
And they could pay more tax.
Which is how he ended the piece.
Streaming is the future, right? It's what will happen?
Well, I expect so. Yeah. And generally, I mean, with all sports broadcasting, right? If you're a consumer, right, you're supposed to suck it up and enjoy it. You're supposed to be grateful for the fact that some new arseholes turned up wanting some of your money. And the fact is that you just want to pay one subscription to one company that will give you the football. They don't give you all the football, just all the football that there is for them to give. Let one company give it to you. You don't want another one and another one. You know, for me as a sports fan, it's bad, unless they have it all, in which case it's all right.
And the only other thing they did, the Opta win probability, which arguably seemed quite pointless.
It's funny that, because I really like that in the cricket. You know, in the World Cup, it was lovely for some reason. And then in the football.
But that's the same as like the third umpire. When Mariah Rasmus is going, just rock and roll it. I'm like, I sort of float to this equilibrium place, whereas when VAR is happening in football, I'm angry.
It makes complete sense on the numbers. I wouldn't say numbers based, but on a game like cricket, which is so related to figures and stats and so forth, and where there are some patterns which are very clearly identifiable. But in football, it's going to be fascinating to see, though. I mean, to come back to the streaming thing, because it's pretty obvious that this is a testing ground, okay, for Amazon, and that all the other big guys are watching what is going on. So first of all, you want to establish, technically, is it possible to do it? Yes, there were a few glitches, but hardly anything to suggest it could be different. Also, it's going to completely change the market, the rights-selling market, and perhaps probably as well the costs and what you bid for things, because these are people who are completely different. They come from different things. Sky, BT comes in. It's as much with the idea of selling you hardware and internet providing and so forth as anything else. Amazon, no, not at all that. It's a content providing and control. It's completely different. So the game is going to change utterly because of that. And it's already in some countries, you already have streaming as a kind of major, the major broadcaster, so to speak. And some, quite a lot of competitions, not the big ones, but for example, the Brazil Championship, the Liga MX, the Argentinian League. A lot of them have sold their rights to streaming services, big ones or smaller ones. So it's going there, I'm afraid.
Two more games tonight, Sheffield United, Newcastle, Arsenal, Brighton. In the Scottish Premiership last night, Neil Lennon called Scott Brown a, quote, modern-day great after his injury time goals saw them beat Hamilton Academicals 2-1. Rangers slipped up at Aberdeen, letting a two-goal lead go. They're now 2 points behind. The bottom's quite fun. St Mirren on 11 points, St Johnstone, Hamilton and Hearts all on 12. That'll do for part two. Part three will be Philippe on the Ballon d'Or and swearing about FIFA. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Ligue 1 last night, Kylian Mbappe and Neymar scored as PSG beat Nantes 2-0 to extend their Ligue 1 lead to 5 points. But Philippe, let's go to the Ballon d'Or. Messi was first, Van Dijk second. Outcry from Liverpool fans and centre-back fans. And it's it's all your fault.
Yeah, it's all my fault, obviously, because it's my magazine, France Football, which created the award and still awards it. And but the biggest scandal was, so to speak, was Sadio Mane not being on the podium, which got a lot of people talking about the motivations behind the choices, as if somehow we decided to tell the members of the jury who to vote for, or lobbied, or put pressure, or anything. And it's certainly nothing of the kind. And yeah, and I think for Liverpool fans, unfortunately, and it's something that we are talking about. I was in Paris yesterday and talked to a couple of France Football friends. The fact that there were so many Liverpool players in the shortlist probably harmed their chances. As in, you know, obviously, if you vote for, you know, Van Dijk, Salah, Mane, Alexander Arnold, and so on, Alisson, you're going to spread the vote, and therefore you're going to miss out on quite a few points and positions, and which might explain why Messi, whom, by the way, I don't think it's a scandal that he's won it. He's had a rather good year, hasn't he? I mean, I might be wrong. He hasn't won the Champions League. He hasn't won the Copa America, but as an individual
player. Flat track bully, isn't he?
Flat track bully, absolutely, yeah. But, I mean, the big question was about Sadio Mane. The fact that he missed out. And when you go into the detail of the vote, it becomes very interesting indeed, if I may go into that, because it was said, implied, insinuated, that somehow because he comes from Senegal, he's a black player, therefore he won't get it. I'm not joking. This is something which has been doing the rounds on various forums and social networks. But what is extraordinary is that the reason Sadio Mane is not on the podium is because the African voters didn't choose him. It's extraordinary, isn't it? He was actually only put on the podium by one out of three members of the jury in Africa, which is crucial because they've got 49 members of the jury. I think it tells you an awful lot about the tensions which exist within, whereas, for example, South America voted for Messi. How was that? Europe tended to go for Van Dijk, which was quite mixed, but tended to go for Van Dijk. You would have expected the African continent to go for one of its own. And, you know, especially since we've been waiting for a long time, in fact, since George Weah to have an African Ballon d'Or, I think this is golden opportunity. But
you talk about Liverpool, the Liverpool vote being split. And actually, the Africa vote was also split.
It was split, yeah.
There's Salah,
but Sadio Mane was to be. I regret it myself. It's probably personal level. I mean, I was asked to vote for the Guardian top 50, mm-hmm. and I voted for Sadio Mane as my number one. And I think many people would have loved to see Sadio Mane and a Liverpool player, you know, representing, including us at France Football, but we don't have a choice about that. There you go.
Megan Rapinoe got the women's vote. Kate, do you think that was more as a figurehead than a footballer?
Yeah, I initially expected to say, I feel this is wrong and Vivian Miedema should have got it. And partly, you know, we've just watched her score two hat-tricks in a single game at the weekend. But then I had a look, and maybe Philippe can tell me if this is right. As I understand it, the criterion that you're given is connected to individual and collective performances during the year, player class in terms of fair play and talent, and kind of on and off the pitch. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So in that sense, I mean, the reason people find it strange and people who are, you know, more like in the weeds and day-to-day of women's football is because Megan Rapinoe has played, I think, 5 times for Reign FC, her NWSL, you know, her domestic team. She has made no assists and scored no goals. She plays kind of on the left of her front three, you might expect she would be. But equally, and they did get to the playoffs, her side, whereas Alex Morgan's Orlando Pride finished bottom of the NWSL, so, and she came in third. The point I would make is, you know, Rapinoe is the oldest player to score in a final of the Women's World Cup. She's 34. She has had the most impact of you could make an argument of any athlete this year. And so, yes, I think it's fair that this is her year. She has had a global impact on and off the pitch, I mean, and she is a figurehead.
Yeah, the thing is that for me, the best Ballon d'Or are the ones who not necessarily are the best players on the planet. That's not the objective of the exercise. But those who embody the most a year, that's the Rapinoe year. Mm. Yeah, and that's correct. True, it is. In the same way that there was the Fabio Cannavaro year, mm-hmm. or the Pavel Nedved, year, and so on. And Was it the Lionel Messi year?
It wasn't, was it?
It wasn't. It was a Liverpool year, but unfortunately the Ballon d'Or is given to an individual. So there you go.
Here's from the Pod Addict. Given it's been a relatively quiet period for FIFA lately, how much content is available for the Philippe Auclair rantometer? Philippe, you've got about a minute to talk about agents.
Well, agents, yes. There's a new report by FIFA TMS, which is absolutely extraordinary. First of all, we haven't finished the year and there are still some markets which are open. There's already been $653 million dollars being spent on agents' commissions, which is, I think, 18 or 19% more than last year. And the extraordinary stat was with Portuguese clubs have spent half as much money on agents' commissions as on transfer fees, which is saying really something.
Fascinating interview Darren Lewis did with the UEFA president, Alexander Seferin, who says he will finally bring black members and women onto the body's disciplinary panel in a bid to get tougher on racism. Some interesting quotes. We didn't do enough. We're not doing enough. Unfortunately, those cases push us. Watching those incidents, not just as a father, as a normal person, as a human being, it's disgusting. Our disciplinary committee and other committees should be more and more diverse. This is off the back of a selection of white men deciding the sanctions for Bulgaria, amongst other racist incidents recently. We have to bring black members in and we have to bring in more women. I agree that sanctions will have to be harsher and harsher, and I'm sure we will. I cannot tell you more, but we will rethink all the disciplinary regulation on diversity in the disciplinarian gravity in the future. One of the governing bodies where this happens will have to have severe sanctions, I know. So we will wait and see with bated breath.
Well, the thing is that the regulations are already in place. It doesn't matter if the members of the commission are black, Asian, whatever. It doesn't matter. They're not being implemented. The way that Seferin is talking about it as if it were a new problem, it's been in place for a long time, mm-hmm. is done bugger all. And that's the way, that's what should be said.
All right. Macclesfield Town's unpaid players say they intend to boycott Saturday's League Two game with crew Alexander at Moss Rose. The BBC is saying it's understood the situation's having such a detrimental effect that the players believe they're not ready physically, mentally and emotionally. As of Wednesday evening, the staff and players' wages remain unpaid following last month's late payment. Sol Campbell, their former manager who's now at Southend, says he's owed £180,000. He's backed a bid from HMRC to wind up the club. The club are now going to appear before the court over their debts on the 18th of December. The Premier League games this weekend, the standout fixture, the Manchester Derby, 5:30 kickoff on Saturday. Can Ole spring a surprise, Kate Mason?
Oh, well, I guess Jonathan Wilson will probably say it would be 2-0 to Manchester United, no?
You never know, dear. It's what makes football great. Finally, a Barry update to finish. Ooh. An hour ago, he tweeted, "Today I've been vandalising an elephant. # India Baz." There's a photo of an elephant with the Football Weekly insignia. Actually quite good, isn't it? He's really done it quite well.
Is this real?
This is real. Obviously,
you shouldn't paint elephants,
well,
should you?
Well, I mean, obviously a lot of people are up in arms about this because of animal rights. Barry is a loving man. He wouldn't paint anything unknowingly, I believe. But I'm not here to defend him. He has followed up people saying, you know, privileged journalist draws on elephant with, "The elephant was rescued from a circus and is in a sanctuary. I paid to paint on it with vegetable dye. Brackets, good for the skin," says Barry. "Scrub it clean, feed it a big box of food and some sugar cane, and have had a short spin on her back. She seemed happy enough to me. Is that okay?"
Well, I didn't know he was so good at reading elephant emotions,
he
Barry.
Is. He really is.
It's a yeah. difficult one, really, isn't
the
it?
The Elephant Whisperer.
Yeah.
Barry Glendinning.
Anyway, that will do for today's pod. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you. That was lovely.
Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Simon.
A great pleasure.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.